The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
It was something like the 154th mass shooting so far this year. Welcome to America, everyone, just in time to celebrate Independence Day. Aren't we lucky? If the song has become all too familiar, it's because I tend to trot it out every time there's another mass shooting in America. I figured 5 dead and 2 injured counts. Only 5 dead. The news media cut away from it after a couple of hours last night. You know, they had to get on with all the other shit that's going on in the world. All the other shit, literal shit that's going on in the world. Welcome to a Friday. I'm Nicole Sandler. Thank you for being here. I am here. I'm going to warn you now. I did not sleep last night. and thank you for all the feedback on restless leg syndrome. It is a weird neurological disorder. In some ways, it's related to Parkinson's disease, but maybe not. There's no cure for it. There are a number of different medications that work on it. The problem is they work for a while, and then it goes through something called augmentation, where, it's just sweet revenge, I guess. It takes the the condition and makes it worse. And I think that's where I'm at with this medication that I'm taking now, because usually what these pills that would help me, if only for a couple of hours at a time, now it seems like I take it and the condition gets worse. So it kicked in last night around 8 o'clock. And I think I was finally able to close my eyes for maybe a half hour at about 7 this morning. So bear with me. The good news is I have a great guest on the show today. And because it is the Friday going into, you know, the 4th of July holiday, he couldn't do it live at 3:30. So we taped it at about noon this afternoon. So I'll be able to sit back and listen with most of you. The shooting, I don't even know where to begin. So, you know, the first, we first got the notification of another mass shooting during the show yesterday. It happened right smack in the middle of the show. And, it was, somebody who went into a newspaper office in Annapolis, Maryland. Funny enough, not funny, haha, funny, sick. What's his name? Milo Yiannopoulos, just the day before, had issued a fatwa of sorts. You know, he said, go get, you know, basically kill a journalist. And that's been a rallying cry of the Trump gang coming right from the top since he decided to vilify the media as part of his marketing strategy. And it's worked. It's worked for him. And now, you know, a journalist, somebody who digs at the truth to uncover the truth, to keep a check and a balance on the government, is there for us. It's for the people. It's the fourth estate, for God's sake. And yeah, and here we are. And now the news that has broken about the shooting was the shooter had a personal vendetta. Apparently he was a Trump fan, but that's besides the point. He, the newspaper reported on something, a lawsuit, and he got pissed and he sued them, and it's been an ongoing thing. And so this was a vendetta. He went purposely to kill some people at that newspaper because he thought they'd done him wrong. By the way, one of the dead is, Carl Hiaasen's brother. Carl Hiaasen, one of my favorite authors. If you want escapism set in South Florida, read a Carl Hiaasen book, or you can also just read his column in the Miami Herald. But Carl Hiaasen, again, you can't go wrong with any of his novels. You'll laugh out loud. And you know what? On a weekend like this, that may not be a bad thing. Get a Carl Hiaasen book and head to the beach or something. Speaking of the long weekend, Wednesday is the 4th of July. I wasn't planning on doing a live show that day anyway. I thought maybe I'd come in and play some 4th of July music or just do something different. But Tuesday I was planning on doing a show, except, I was able to get into a new neurologist on Tuesday afternoon, right around the time the show was on the air. So, excuse me. My health is more important at this point. So at this, there will not be a show on Tuesday. So, no show Tuesday. On Wednesday, I'll try to do a special 4th of July music show, and then we'll be back to as normal as we can possibly be on Thursday. Again, I'm sorry for how I'm sounding. This is just, me, horribly sleep deprived. All right. Ian Millhiser of Think Progress is with us today. He's the justice editor, and he wrote a book. Let me give you the name of the book so I don't screw it up and get it wrong. Injustices, it's called. The Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. And we'll talk all about the monster mess that is going on with the Supreme Court now. Just, you know, the last wrench thrown in our collective gears this past week. I don't even know where to begin. I don't know. But I'll tell you what we'll do is let's just get started with what's news, shall we?
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Well, the 38-year-old suspect in the shooting at the Capital Gazette newsroom in Maryland on Thursday had a long-running feud with the newspaper and sued it for defamation back in 2012. Authorities believe the targeted attack, which left five people dead and two injured, was part of a vendetta against the newspaper.
The Free Press took a huge hit yesterday. The deadly shooting that killed five people at the Capital Gazette, a newspaper based out of Annapolis, Maryland. Overnight, the suspected gunman was charged with five counts of first-degree murder. A bail hearing has been set for later this morning. We've also learned that the suspect sued the Capital Gazette for defamation in 2012 after a columnist wrote a blog about his guilty plea to criminal harassment in 2011. A court ruled in the Capital Gazette's favor, and an appeals court upheld the ruling. Police were notified about an active shooter just before 3 p.m. yesterday. Reporter Phil Davis, who was inside the building when the shots first rang out, tweeted that a gunman shot through the glass door to the office and opened fire on multiple employees. In a later interview with the Baltimore Sun, Davis said it was, quote, like a war zone inside the newspaper's offices. He said, and others were hiding under their desks when the gunman stopped firing. According to police, authorities took a suspect into custody without any exchange of fire. Despite yesterday's shooting, reporters and editors at the Capital Gazette continued to report on the tragedy last night.
Now, reporter Selena Sanfelice spoke with CNN last night and expressed the frustration that many of us are feeling.
This is going to be a story for how many days? Less than a week. People will forget about us after a week, unless, you know, we keep tweeting. I don't really care about tweeting right now. I honestly didn't even expect to be talking with Anderson Cooper today. I thought people would get like a Apple News notification and they would just blow it off. Like what happens to everybody. I reported on Pulse when Pulse happened. I went to school in Florida, and I remember being so upset hearing about the victims who were texting their families. And there I was sitting under a desk texting my parents, telling them that I loved them. And I just don't know what I want right now, right? But I'm going to need more than a couple days of news coverage and some thoughts and prayers, because it's our whole lives have been shattered. And so thanks for your prayers, but I couldn't give a fuck about them if there's nothing else.
And she said that was live on CNN. Thanks for your thoughts and prayers, but I couldn't give a fuck about them if there's nothing else. That was a reporter who works at the newspaper who was hiding under a desk for her life as she's, you know, texting her parents that she loves her. So Senator Marco Rubio, though, seemed more offended by a word than by the murders. He tweeted, "Sign of our times, the F word is now routinely used in news stories, tweets, etc. It's not even F, you know, asterisk anymore. Who made that decision?" Hey, Marco, fuck you. As the details were just breaking, Fox so-called news Sean Hannity suggested that Congresswoman Maxine Waters was to blame for the shooting somehow.
By the way, we're getting some breaking news that there was a shooting at the what's called Capital Gazette newspaper in Annapolis, Maryland. The Baltimore Sun is now reporting. We have multiple deaths also being reported, and the sheriff is saying the multiple fatalities in a newsroom shooting. Oh, good grief. So scary. The suspect, though, has been apprehended, according to the sheriff. And we'll continue to follow that story. It's so sad that there are so many sick, demented, and evil people in this world. It really is sad.
Yeah, you're one of
them. Imagine you go to work, and this is what you're dealing with today. Some crazy person comes in. And I'm not turning this into a gun debate. I know that's where the media will be in 30 seconds from now. That's not it. You know, as I've always said, I mean, honestly, I've been saying now for days that something horrible is going to happen because of the rhetoric. Really, Maxine, you want people to create, call your friends, get in their faces, and Obama said that too. Get in their faces.
Yeah,
call
and it's out. Your guy
call
who
your
was
friends.
Your guy
you know, get
who was
protesters.
Your and it was your guy who was telling people to hurt them, to harm them, to beat them up. He'll pay the legal fees. Meanwhile, Maxine Waters has had to cancel public events in Texas and Alabama because of a very serious death threat made against her. Unreal. Shockwaves continue reverberating around the Supreme Court. Justice Anthony Kennedy's announcement that he's retiring from the bench. The fight to replace Kennedy is expected to be the most expensive Supreme Court confirmation battle in history. Conservative groups predict they'll exceed their past expenditures over the summer and fall to boost Trump's forthcoming nominee, who will change the ideological balance of the court for years to come. Amazing. Liberal groups are also expected to spend freely and have warned that Trump's pick would tip the scales against the Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion. We're so screwed. We're just so fucking screwed. Cory Booker is suggesting that a president who's the subject of an investigation shouldn't be able to nominate a justice who might have, a little conflict of interest.
The president of the United States right now is a subject of an ongoing criminal investigation, an investigation that every member of this committee knows could end up before the Supreme Court. This is a committee that has shown its ability to work across the aisle. I'm really proud of the things that I've been able to work with a number of people on this committee.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to interject, but I don't think we know the president's under a criminal investigation. In fact,
Comey
told him three times he was not. So I don't know what the senator is referring to.
I said very clearly and very carefully that the president is the subject of a criminal investigation, an investigation that
I don't think that's true either.
Well, we're reasonable minds can disagree. We've seen numerous people that are close to the president, numerous people that are on the president's campaign, numerous people in the campaigns under the president's investigation who have been pled guilty, who have been clearly under investigation, and this all could end up before the Supreme Court. And we have a president who in the past has seemed to be asking people for loyalty tests.
Yep.
That has seemed to have had litmus tests in regard to this investigation.
Yep.
And so if we are not going to thoroughly discuss what it means to have a president with this ongoing investigation happening, who is now going to be able to interview Supreme Court justices and potentially continue with his tradition of doing litmus tests, loyalty tests for that person, we could be participating in a process that could undermine that criminal investigation. And I think it's in the best interest of our democracy for this committee to consider a nominee from a president. I think it's questionable should we be considering a nominee from a president who has a history of demanding these loyalty tests.
Good question.
And we could be responsible for participating in something that could undermine that investigation. And so I do not believe that this committee should or can in good conscience consider a nominee put forward by this president until that investigation is concluded. And so not only do I believe that we should abide by the rule set by McConnell, but I think we should look at the larger moment we're in American history, the conflict of interest that's clearly present with this president, and we should delay this until the Mueller investigation is concluded.
Good try. It won't work. We'll discuss that with Ian Millhiser in just a few minutes. But good try, Cory Booker. Good try. And just because there hasn't been enough crap thrown against the news wall this week, Trump wants to pull out of the WTO.
The president wants to pull the United States out of the WTO. That is huge. Out of the World Trade Organization, that would be a bombshell. But it's not out of the realm of possibility for this president, who has made similar remarkable moves. This is despite the fact that the United States has won 87% of the cases brought before the WTO since 1995. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin this morning on Fox News says, no, that Axios reporting is way overblown. It's an exaggeration. What would pulling out of the WTO, though, get the president?
A lot of pushback from Republicans in Congress. I don't think it's surprising that the president is talking about this. The WTO is a direct threat to his protectionist views and the tariffs he wants to slap on other countries. It's one of the only international organizations that actually has teeth. And so if it finds that the U.S. has actually implemented unfair trade practices, it can punish the U.S. and basically create some sort of sanctions that hurt American businesses and Americans in terms of prices. So that's why you're going to see the president pushing back on them. Obviously, they're going to be looking at his steel and aluminum tariffs and deciding whether or not those are fair. So perhaps this is a preemptive attack on the WTO. But on the Hill, Republicans would never go for this. And in the same Axios report, they noted that Congress would actually have to approve withdrawing from the WTO. But Republicans see the WTO as something helpful. They can take other countries to the WTO and say, listen, they're hurting our companies and this is unfair. Right. And as you said, often the U.S. wins. So why would they do this?
Because their heads are up their asses, because they don't know what the fuck they're doing, because Donald Trump is a moron. He is an ignoramus of the nth degree. He is such an idiot. And the thing is, he's not dumb. He, I always used to say a little bit of knowledge is so dangerous, because he takes his little bit of knowledge and acts like he knows everything, and he knows nothing. He is running this nation down a toilet, and I don't know that we're going to be able to survive it. I really don't. You know, on top of all this other stuff, there's this just crossed my Twitter feed from MSNBC. Numbers provided by the Department of Homeland Security show that 1,768 children were separated from their parents between October 2016 and February 2018, bringing the total number of separated kids to more than 4,100. What is wrong with us? This shining city on a hill that, you know, so many used to aspire to be like, to want to live, to you know, emulate. We are just, I would say, a laughing stock. It's not nothing funny about it at all. And to just throw one more bit of hypocrisy in it, here's a quote from Donald Trump from today. Before going any further today, I want to address the horrific shooting that took place yesterday at the Capital Gazette newsroom in Annapolis, Maryland. This attack shocked the conscience of our nation and filled our hearts with grief. At some point, he said something. Of course, I can't find the quote. Basically saying that nobody, journalist or any other profession, should have to worry about their safety while doing their job. This from the guy who calls journalists the enemy of the people. Again, we are so fucked. So fucked. And if someone can tell me a way out of it, I'm looking. I'm looking. All right. You know what? Let's get Ian Millhiser on the line, shall we? We'll take a teeny tiny break and then back with Ian Millhiser of Think Progress next. Don't go away. I'm Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The Nicole Sandler Show is 100% listener supported. Have you given yet? Nicole decided not to put her show behind a paywall, knowing that many can't afford the luxury of paying for a podcast. But if you're able to, she needs your financial support to continue doing this. Consider a monthly subscription. Give when you can. Just visit NicoleSandler.com/donate. Remember, she can't do this without you.
Ian Millhiser is justice editor at Think Progress and author of the book Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. And I love that you describe it as a book about what a miserable, illiberal, anti-democratic institution the Supreme Court of the United States is. That's a pretty good description of it.
Yeah, it turns out I'm right, unfortunately. Yeah.
Unbelievable. So the court wrapped up its term this week with a few pretty devastating decisions and one earth-shattering retirement announcement. In fact, the New York Daily News had on its front cover yesterday, "We're fucked," and I have to agree. Can you remember a time when the Supreme Court seemed so, hopeless?
Well, I mean, most of the court's history is like this. I mean, we're talking about an institution that struck down child labor laws. We're talking about the institution that created separate but equal. The Supreme Court, I mean, this is the thrust of the argument of my book, for almost all of its history has been pretty damn miserable. And I think that we have forgotten how bad things can get when you have an illiberal Supreme Court. And we're about to get a very frightening reminder.
Truly. You wrote a piece up at Think Progress about, let me see if I can find the exact title here, because it was pretty to the point. Justice Kennedy deserves this nasty, unflinching send-off. Anthony Kennedy was a horrible justice, and his last decision was his worst. He got a lot of slack over the years because he did occasionally come up with what you and I might consider the right swing vote, but not often enough.
Yeah, like, I mean, the way to think about Anthony Kennedy is in 1988, when he was put on the court, he was considered to be a very, very conservative judge. I mean, he wasn't the most conservative person who could have been put up, but he was very, very conservative. And Kennedy more or less stood still as the Republican Party sprinted to the right. So, you know, imagine the sort of person that Ronald Reagan would say, yeah, that's a really conservative guy, and I feel comfortable with him on the Supreme Court. That's who Anthony Kennedy was. And that meant he wrote Citizens United. Mm. That meant he wrote a lot of decisions nuking workers' rights, you know, saying that your boss can force you to sign away your rights if you want to continue to work there. You know, he was bad. He tried to repeal the entire Affordable Care Act. And when he was with us, He often did it in a very, you know, sort of parsimonious, reluctant way. So it took him a really long time to come along on gay rights. He, you know, his abortion decisions, he wouldn't kill Roe outright, but he decided a lot of cases where he shrunk the right to choose a great deal. So he's the sort of guy who, like, you know, when you're surrounded by monsters, the guy who's your 30% friend looks like a really great guy. But he wasn't a good justice. I mean, he was just better than the other four Republicans on the court.
Which isn't saying much. And now that he's retiring. Now, there were a lot of hints that he wasn't ready to retire yet. He had named his clerks for next year. The speculation was that he was going to hang around for at least another year. And then there was a piece in the New York Times yesterday that basically said that there was a concerted effort of sorts in the West Wing to get Kennedy to retire. You tweeted about that article that Anthony Kennedy is exactly as naive and vain as we always knew him to be. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, Trump just basically sucked up to the guy. I mean, like, you know, Trump's kids are friends with one of Kennedy's kids, and Trump would talk about how much he likes Kennedy's son. And I mean, you know, I mean, you could do your little charm offensive, but the man is still Donald Trump. And I mean, it's shocking to me that, you know, we're talking about a Harvard grad who's seen a lot of things, who, you know, has in the past, like, you know, he recognized the threat that George W. Bush presented during the Guantanamo crisis and frequently voted against George W. Bush on issues related to Guantanamo. So it's not like Justice Kennedy isn't capable of seeing a threat to civil liberties. And yet for some reason he was blinded by Trump because of this charm offensive. I am surprised that he turned out to be, you know, so easily manipulated.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, the charm offensive that works on Trump, as foreign leaders are discovering, you flatter him a little bit, it goes a long way.
I mean, apparently that's the coin of the realm right now. You know, it doesn't matter if you want to burn everything down or ban Muslims or lock children up in concentration camps, so long as, you know, you can be charming.
Right. So we have no idea yet what the next term will bring. We do know that this term, which just wrapped up this week, was not not one for much celebration. In fact, as they tend to do, they save the big decisions for last. And this past week has been sort of one giant blow after another. What was the, in your opinion, Ian Millhiser, what was the worst opinion the court handed down this term?
Well, the Muslim ban opinion is just awful. I mean, so the holding of the Muslim ban case, well, the facts of that case are that Trump bragged as a candidate that he was going to ban Muslims over and over again, ban Muslims from entering the country.
Yep.
And then someone got to him and said, hey, dude, if you can't say that because that's unconstitutional. So then he literally gave a Meet the Press interview where he said, oh, people are saying I can't say ban Muslims anymore, so I'm not going to say that anymore. Instead, I'm going to say territories. I'm going to say that I'm going to ban people from certain countries. And that's how, you know, that's how that's going to work now. And then his current lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, went on TV, and Giuliani said, oh, yeah, Trump asked us to assemble a commission. And what the commission's job was, again, this is all public. The commission's job was to figure out a way to do a Muslim ban so that the courts will uphold it. And what the commission told Trump is, yeah, oh, just don't call it a Muslim ban. Say that you're banning people from certain countries. And then Trump banned people from certain majority Muslim countries. So he said he was going to violate the Constitution. He told you how he was going to do it. He told you how he was going to create a pretext so the thing he was doing didn't look like what he was doing. And then he did it. And in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court said, ah, so what? Trump can do that.
It is stunning. And there's no recourse. I mean, this is the Supreme Court. There's no further, there's no way to appeal it. This is it.
Right. That's it. Yeah. And, you know, with whoever winds up coming in, you know, whether it's Brett Kavanaugh or Amy Barrett or, you know, Mike Lee or whoever, with whoever comes in to fill the seat, like, there's now no longer people who are someone who is persuadable on nearly any issue that can come up. I mean, Roberts, I think, is better than a total nihilist like Neil Gorsuch.
Mm-hmm.
But Chief Justice Roberts is really, really conservative. And he's tremendously conservative, especially on voting rights. So what I'm afraid of is that when you have a Supreme Court that is fairly hostile to voting rights, you risk having a situation where Trump, or at least Trump's party, gets entrenched pretty hard because the people who oppose them can't cast a ballot to throw them out of office.
Right. We had some hope in this term that something might be done about partisan gerrymandering, and those hopes were dashed in the last couple of weeks, weren't they?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I look back at the term, it's clear that Kennedy made the decision to retire several months ago.
Yeah.
Because, you know, early in the term, he seemed to be acting like his normal self, and he seemed very skeptical of partisan gerrymandering. And then when the decisions actually started coming down, you know, he punted on partisan gerrymandering. He punted on this issue of whether religious faith can be used as an excuse to discriminate. He sided in every 5-4 decision where the liberal bloc and the conservative bloc split. Kennedy voted with the conservative. He wasn't actually a swing justice this time. He voted as a straight line Republican this term. And it's just clear when you look back on it that he was already checked out. He decided, I don't want to hand down a bunch of opinions that are just going to get overruled 5 minutes after I leave. And so he spent his last year on the Supreme Court in a senior slump.
Hmm. Wow. The other things, I mean, I'm looking down a list, one that was compiled by Sail Kapoor of in their last few decisions of the year, Supreme Court upheld the Muslim ban. OK's Ohio's voter purge, which is pretty stunning, which again goes to voting rights, backed the anti-gay wedding maker, cake maker, allows gerrymandered maps, OK's online betting and sales tax, smacks public sector unions. That was a biggie. That was one of the worst for last. Backs businesses over workers when it comes to arbitration and kills California abortion rights laws. Speaking of abortion rights, we haven't even seen the beginning of what they're going to do to Roe v. Wade, have we?
Yeah, no, Roe v. Wade's toast. I don't know if the Supreme Court is actually going to write the words Roe v. Wade is overruled,
mm-hmm.
or if they will do what I think is more likely, which is that they will nominally keep a shell of Roe alive, but every abortion restriction that a state passes, they'll come up with some way to affirm it. And so you'll wind up in a world like the world that Texas tried to create in a decision that, you know, where Justice Kennedy said, no, Texas couldn't do this. So what Texas did is they imposed really expensive and unnecessary requirements on abortion clinics. So like the halls had to be a certain width. They had to have really expensive operating rooms,
right,
even if the clinic only provided medication abortions. So they didn't need an operating room because they weren't doing any surgeries. There were a lot of there were just a lot of very expensive requirements that just make no sense. And then they also put really strict credentialing requirements. They imposed them on the doctors so that most doctors wouldn't be able to perform abortions because it was very hard to get those credentials. So the world we could be living in a year from now, wow, is going to be a world where a state says, okay, you can perform abortions, but you have to have a building made out of gold. And the operating room has to have a magical laser in it. And if you want to perform the abortion yourself, you have to complete a 100,000-hour training course that is taught by the Pope.
Right.
And so long as you do all those things, you can have an abortion clinic. That's what I think the future is likely to look like, is that the future, maybe they will overrule out Roe v. Wade outright. But one way or another, if you live in a state where the lawmakers don't support abortion, you're not going to be able to get an abortion.
This is frightening. I mean, this is something out of a dystopian novel that you never thought would actually happen, and now we're finding we're living in it. So Ian Millhiser is with us. He's the justice editor over at Think Progress, who's the author of the book Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Back when FDR took office, and I'm not a great history buff, but the court was packed pretty tightly, right? And he attempted to do something that you call court packing. Right. Can you explain what that was about and how, if it could possibly work again?
I will, but I have to say, the fact that you're asking me that question, mm-hmm, shows how terrible this moment. And you're the third person, this is the third interview I've had this week where someone's asked me about court packing.
Wow.
Court packing is the equivalent of launching a nuclear strike against a foreign enemy, because that enemy is fueling its missiles. And if you don't take out their missile silos, you're going to die. I mean, court packing is the desperate, things are so bad that our only option is to destroy the legitimacy of the judiciary in order to prevent something much, much worse than happening. It's something very, very serious. Court packing, the Constitution doesn't say how many judges sit on the Supreme Court.
Right.
And so the next president could come in, they could say, oh, we're going to have an 11-justice court, we're going to have a 15-justice court, and then appoint those seats, and then you have a new majority. The only circumstance where I think court packing is justified is if you have a renegade court that has essentially destroyed America's character as a democracy, either by, allowing voter suppression laws that make it impossible for us to have competitive elections, or by, just saying that we're going to strike down anything that one party enacts. And until that party's voters become too discouraged and they don't show up at the polls, and then we're back in power again. And what's so frightening right now, I am hopeful that Chief Justice Roberts is going to realize that he doesn't want to push us to the point where court packing becomes an option. And so I'm hopeful that he will stay his hand more than, say, Gorsuch would. But there is a very real risk where we're going to have to choose between having an independent judiciary and having a democracy. And that's absolutely terrifying to me.
Well, there's a lot of concern that, for instance, Trump has been a bit perturbed with Neil Gorsuch, that perhaps he hasn't been loyal enough to him. This is a president who does not understand the separation of powers and does demand loyalty oaths from people that he nominates to positions, whether it be FBI director or Supreme Court justice. Is there a concern that, here's a guy who's under investigation, this court may have to rule on a number of things having to do with Trump, and yet Trump is going to be the person responsible for nominating the next justice?
So here's the thing. Trump is getting played right now. I mean, he's too stupid to know it. But, like, Trump has essentially delegated the judicial nominations, the task of selecting judges to a handful of conservative groups, mostly to the Federalist Society and a Federalist Society executive named Leonard Leo. And the Federalist Society, I mean, like, they're happy with Trump right now because he's given them this power, but, like, they aren't necessarily Trumpians. What they want is they want a world where, like, agencies like the EPA and the Department of Labor aren't allowed to regulate. They want a world where much of the New Deal and the Great Society is declared unconstitutional. They want a world where states have pretty broad leeway to suppress the vote. And they want a world where if you're a religious conservative, you get to pick which laws you don't want to follow. And for the most part, if you don't want to follow those laws, you don't have to. That's their vision. That's a terrifying vision. But it's a different vision than the sort of cult of personality that Trump embodies. And he's just given them the power to pick judges. So, like, the threat that the Supreme Court presents right now, I don't think it's that they're going to entrench Donald Trump forever, because the minute Donald Trump's no longer useful to them, you know, Neil Gorsuch doesn't give a damn about Donald Trump. He's, you know, he's not going to bend over backward to protect Trump unless it's useful for him to do so. You know, what their goal is just to get 5 votes to implement this vision where it doesn't matter who the president is, because our policy is being set by the Supreme Court of the United States.
So what recourse do we have? I mean, from my vantage point, not much. We've got a 51-49 majority for the Republicans in the Senate, although it's really 50-49 because John McCain is in Arizona and doesn't look like he's coming back anytime soon. Of course, McConnell did away with the filibuster for the Supreme Court pick at Gorsuch time. Thank you very much. Is there any hope that anybody is going to stand up to McConnell, to Trump, really, and block somebody who might be extreme?
So the only hope is Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, so Republican senators from Maine and Alaska, respectively, and both of them claim to be pro-choice. And what Collins and Murkowski need to understand, and if anyone listening is from Maine or Alaska, they should help them understand it by never stopping with the phone calls. But what Collins and Murkowski need to understand is a vote for Trump's nominee is a vote to overrule Roe v. Wade. You know, it's a lot of other things too, but like if you vote yes on this nominee, you are saying yes, Roe v. Wade should be overruled. And so Susan Collins in particular, she's from a blue state. She's from Maine.
Right.
So in 2020, she can run for reelection as the senator who saved Roe v. Wade, or she can run for reelection as the senator who cast the deciding vote to kill Roe v. Wade. That's her choice. And if she understands that's her choice, you know, maybe there's a chance she's going to, she's going to realize, oh, I actually am pro-choice. And I actually don't want Roe to be overruled. But I mean, what everyone needs to understand, and anyone who has the ability to yell at Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski should make sure they understand this. A yes vote for this nominee is a vote to overrule Roe v. Wade. And the only leverage point that I know of are these two Republican senators who claim to support abortion rights.
Right. Then what about the so-called red state senators who are up for re-election, Heidi Heitkamp and Joe Donnelly and Joe Manchin? Those are all cause for concern, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, it is a cause for concern. I mean, the math here is really hard. I mean, I hope what they understand is that a vote for Trump's nominee is a vote to give states pretty broad discretion to enact voter suppression laws. And so, you know, if you're Joe Donnelly and you're from the red state of Indiana, you want your your Republican legislature and your Republican governor to decide whether or not your voters get to show up at the polls next time. So, you know, I mean, that's what I would say to Donnelly and to Man, like, you know, your ability to get elected is that we continue to have elections where the system isn't any more rigged than it already is. And so, you know, forget about Roe v. Wade for them. Like, the question is, do you still want to be a senator? And if you still want to be a senator, you need to be able to compete in a fair election.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, obviously, one of the biggest issues being brought out in terms of the consequences of this decision is the end of Roe v. Wade. Very selfishly, I worry about the future of the Affordable Care Act, which is hanging on by the thinnest of all threads right now. Am I wrong in thinking that the minute Trump's new nominee is confirmed, that's the final nail in the coffin?
Hopefully not. I mean, the deciding vote there is Roberts. I mean, Roberts was the one who flipped originally. He's the one who, you know, rejected the second attack on the law. I think that Roberts has made it very clear that, like, he does not want derpy lawsuits attacking Obamacare to, like, to come before his court because he thinks that it politicizes the court. And I'm hopeful that he's going to continue to hold the line on that. But there will be four justices who will accept any ludicrous theory. And there's a case out of Texas that has an especially ludicrous one. It will accept any ridiculous theory to repeal the Affordable Care Act. And if one more person goes, I mean, it's not just the Affordable Care Act that's on the line at that point. I mean, at that point, we could actually have a majority to say things like the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is unconstitutional.
Oh, God. I feel like the worst dystopian novel that's been sitting on my bookshelf has just opened and it's sprung to life.
Yeah, no, I was about to say, like, you know, the other night I was going to watch The Handmaid's Tale, and I just had to turn it off. It was a bit too on the nose.
Yeah, no, I watched the first season of it, and even that was a bit too dark for me, because I've been struggling with, you know, life in the Trump era, and I was warned by somebody. You know, the first season was okay. Stay away from the second season because it's just misery porn.
Yeah, no, as it turns out, The Handmaid's Tale is a documentary now.
Oh, God. Another big, you know, I'm thinking over the last few years and some of the great victories we've won. Obergefell versus Hodges, you know, the LGBT rights, the end of DOMA.
Right.
All of this is under threat, isn't it?
I mean, it's even worse than, I mean, it's not just marriage equality that's potentially threatened right now. Lawrence v. Texas was the, I think it was a 2003 decision saying that you can't criminalize sex. You know, I mean, specifically in that case involved two gay men. So it, you know, it involved gay sex in that case. But generally, like, you cannot criminalize consensual sexual activity between adults. And there are no longer five votes on the Supreme Court who believe that laws criminalizing gay sex or sex generally are unconstitutional.
Wow.
Now, I don't know. I mean, Roberts is a bit squishy on whether or not he'll like respect prior precedents. And so maybe he'll decide, you know, I don't want to take away a bunch of people's marriage licenses. And I certainly don't want to be remembered as the guy as sex. But there are no longer five votes for that proposition.
It's just frightening. Do we have any? I know that Trump has put out lists. I think as vetted by the Federalist Society of acceptable justices. So if he's going to go off that list of what 25 names or so, we pretty much know what we're going to get. It's just which one and you know which is worse than the other.
Yeah. No. I mean it's 25 terrible names. I don't know who it will be. I mean, if I had to put money on it, I think the two front runners are a guy named Brett Kavanaugh, who sits on the DC circuit and is sort of a conservative wonky type who like would in a very smart and sophisticated way dismantle the EPA. And then the, you know, the other front runner, I think, is a woman named Amy Coney Barrett, who is much more the socially conservative mold. I mean, she's criticized Roe v. Wade pretty explicitly. She signed a letter attacking the Obama administration's contraception policy. I mean, I think both Kavanaugh and Barrett and like most of the people on that list would vote pretty much the same. But, you know, I suspect that the calculation that's going on is, you know, do they want someone like Kavanaugh who is going to really please the Federalist Society types and is going to like show Trump's commitment to Republican donors who don't like agency regulation? Or do they really want to charge up the religious right? And if the latter is true, you know, I think that Barrett is, you know, the person to do that with.
But regardless, we're screwed. Cory Booker made some noise yesterday saying that, you know, forget the McConnell rule that, you know, you don't put up a justice for a nomination during an election year. And McConnell's quick to point out, I said presidential.
The McConnell rule was always a lie. I mean, The McConnell rule is Mitch McConnell doesn't like Barack Obama.
Right.
And yeah, it's a fun game to point out hypocrisy, and everyone should know what a lying hypocrite Mitch McConnell is. But the problem is that Mitch McConnell is proud of how much of a lying hypocrite he is. I mean, for him, hypocrisy is power. You know, I got to tell a blatant lie about why I was doing this thing, and I got away with it. You know, that. So, like, you know, he's a terrible human who doesn't care that he's a terrible human.
Right. Could Obama have done anything? I mean, it seems like the Merrick Garland fuck-up, and it's the only way I can describe it, was a massive generational screw up. What could have been done?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything Obama could have done to get the Republicans to decide to confirm anyone he nominated. I mean, they were committed to that strategy. I do think that Merrick Garland was like, you know, the strategy behind Merrick Garland is that he was an older white guy who was viewed as a moderate. And Obama thought that if he put up the compromise nominee, then some Republicans would meet him halfway and Garland would be confirmed. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't going to happen. I will tell you, a buddy of mine who worked in the White House asked me a few days before the confirmation or before the nomination who I would pick. And I told him that he should pick a guy named Tino Cuellar, who sits on the California Supreme Court right now, former Stanford professor, really smart guy. But the reason he should have picked Tino Cuellar is that in addition to being eminently qualified to be a Supreme Court justice, Cuellar is a Mexican immigrant, mm-hmm. and Donald Trump would have lost his goddamn mind if Obama had picked a Mexican immigrant, and maybe that would have, you know, helped move the needle on the election a little more. I think they ran the wrong political play on Garland, but I'm under no illusion that, like, if Obama had picked Cuellar or someone else, that the Republicans would have said, oh, well, we're going to confirm this person.
Right. No, nor do I. So, you know, the Democrats are trying to come up with some kind of strategy to delay it till after the midterms, hoping that the Democrats will somehow miraculously take back control of the Senate, in which case things change. But Cory Booker is pushing a different thing. And he's saying, look, Trump is under investigation and he should not be allowed to nominate a judge who may have to rule on something having to do with him. Is there any credence to that argument?
I mean, it's a great argument. I agree with it. But like, we're not talking about who is the best argument right now.
Nope.
We're talking about who has power right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, Republicans have power right now. And if they decide to use it, now who knows? I mean, maybe Cory Booker is really good friends with Lisa Murkowski, and maybe that argument is really going to resonate with Lisa Murkowski. And if it does, like, you know, Cory Booker deserves a lot of plaudits for figuring out the way to get to you know. But the question we need to be asking now is not what is the best argument for doing the right thing. The question we need to be asking now are there any Republican senators who could be made to see the light, and how do you convince them? And, you know, there may be other arguments, but the best one I know is to get Collins and Murkowski to understand that they will be voting to overrule Roe v. Wade if they vote yes.
Right, and then get Heitkamp and Donnelly and Manchin and the others to stand in line. And
yeah.
You know, the for all of the shouting about how obstructionist the Democrats are, you know, boy, what short memories they have of what we lived through for the last 8 years before Trump came into office.
Yeah, and, you know, to Booker's credit, I mean, maybe he's making this argument because he thinks, you know, maybe he's saying, you know, Donald Trump's under investigation because, like, you know, he knows that Manchin and Heitkamp and Donnelly will care about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have to hold on to them, too. But, you know, at the end of the day, this comes down, you know, this comes down to power. This comes down to whether or not Mitch McConnell is able to get 51 people to say, you know what, there's this orange guy in the White House who's super racist and who didn't even win the popular vote. And who has no idea what he's doing. And I think that guy should be the one to pick the next justice on the Supreme Court.
God. I keep wanting to wake up from the nightmare, and it's just not happening. Ian Millhiser, what last question is, what can we do? What should we be doing? I mean, I know our options are limited. What should each and every one of us be doing?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, never stop calling your senator, especially if you're in Alaska or Maine, but never stop calling your senator. If your senator has a public event, go to that and yell very, very loudly about, you know, how we need to make sure that this person isn't confirmed. And make sure that senators understand that this is unacceptable and make them feel like they'll pay a price for turning over the judiciary to Donald Trump.
Yeah. Well, let's hope. I mean, we got nothing to lose. We actually have everything to lose. So it's all hands on deck time and vote. I mean, that's the most important thing we can do. And you know, taking back the House is important right now, taking back the Senate, because let's face it, I love Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but she's not a kid. And if he's given a third Supreme Court seat to fill, I don't think we'll recognize this country.
Yeah, if he gets to replace one of the liberals, we are no longer going to be living in anything that resembles a democracy.
Mm. Well, that's an uplifting note to go on into the 4th of July weekend with. But it should, you know, I've been trying to reframe myself away from despair and more towards anger and action. So, you know, we got to fight this with everything we've got because it's, you know, our democracy depends on it.
Yep. No, and you're right. You know, everyone's got to vote.
Ian Millhiser. Find him on the Twitters at iMillhiser with two L's. He's justice editor at Think Progress and author of the book Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Thank you so much. I wish the answers could have been different, but I appreciate the information.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. I really appreciate your time. Take care. And there you go, Ian Millhiser of Think Progress. I got to, thankfully, record that with him a little earlier today. I guess he wanted to get an early start on the 4th of July weekend. And it helped me because I'm sleep deprived. So I'm going to put up the podcast and do what I need to do. And then hopefully my legs will cooperate and I'll lie back down. If you're looking for something to do tomorrow, June 30th is the day of action. Families Belong Together. You can go to familiesbelongtogether.org to get the information on a rally, a march near you. Take to the streets to say that families belong together and demand that we reunite families and end family separation and detention. There's so much that we have to fight back against. It is easy to fall into despair. Believe me, I know firsthand. It's best to try to keep busy and stay constructive. Join a Democratic club. I'm telling you, that's on my list of things that I'm going to do. I'm going to get out of this mode of isolation and try to participate. Don't forget, there will not be a show on Tuesday because I am seeing a new neurologist who will hopefully help my restless leg syndrome so I can sleep and be more present with you. And Wednesday at NicoleSandler.com, we'll do some kind of a 4th of July music show, okay? Thank you for listening. Have a great 4th of July. And let's try to keep in mind what this country used to be about. Bring us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Lady Liberty, we know what you stand for, not the orange thing in the Oval Office. Happy 4th, everyone. Have a great weekend. Bye.